Shalom Aleichem, everyone. I'd like to welcome our Rabbanim, and particularly to welcome Rabbi Mordechai Willig Shlita, who will now present for our Shilas presented to Rebbe. This is the 14th class, and we welcome Rebbe and the group. Thank you, Rabbi Willig.
Thank you. Question number one. May a son-in-law call a stepfather-in-law by his first name? Excellent question. The Minchas Chinuch in Mitzvah Lamed Gimel, Kibbut Av Ve'Em, tells us as follows. There is a concept that Kibbut Av is not limited to a father and mother proper, but extends to other relatives. One of them is Achiv HaGadol, the oldest brother. The Rabbah's Achiv HaGadol. Says the Minchas Chinuch that a person may call an older brother by his first name to his face, as we all know, not a problem. Some of the Mefarshim are Medayik from the Minchas Chinuch. He only made the statement with respect to an older brother. Now with respect to other relatives that are derived from Ribuyim, such as a stepfather and such as a father-in-law. This can be found, for example, in the Sefer Yalkut Yosef. And he quotes this from Rebbe Yashiv, with respect to a father-in-law. And it seems to me that if it's true of a stepfather and it's true of a father-in-law, then it should be equally true with respect to a stepfather-in-law. In the real world, we no longer have the concept of giving greater respect to those who are older. Look in the Sfarim that discuss Kibbut Av Ve'Em, they say, over and above the father-in-law or stepfather relationship, even with respect to any individual who was a generation older, not appropriate to call them by straight or first name without any titles preceding it. And therefore, it's even more troubling to me when we see people calling their in-laws or step-parents by a first name. It certainly shouldn't be allowed in that fashion. Now, if you add a title before, there are certain leniencies. I'll speak of a personal situation which I had myself when my father remarried. We weren't sure how do we refer to his wife, a stepmother. Now, remember, we're talking about a situation where the children are married out of the house. What do you do? So we spoke to Rabbi Wagner, Zichrono Livracha, who was at that time a senior rabbi, came from the same part of Europe where my father came from, and he said, you call her, with the Yiddish term, Tanta. So if her name is Rachel, you don't call her stepmother, just plain Rachel. Tanta Rachel. And that's what we did. But then my father's wife didn't like the title. She preferred that we call her by the honorific title of Safta before her first name, which we did. So if you're using an honorific title of Tanta, Safta, whatever the person prefers, I believe this is permissible. But to use the name straight without any honorific preface, I believe is inappropriate. This is all referring to, as I mentioned, adult children, children who are married and out of the house. There are sometimes cases of very young children entering into situations of step-parents. That's a very complicated issue. Often, unfortunately in today's world too often, it's a result of a divorce and not a death. Makes it more complicated because the person now has a natural parent and a step-parent. I believe it's not appropriate to refer to the step-parent with the same title with which you refer to the natural parent. A different title should be used. For example, if the person calls his natural father Daddy, should call the stepfather Abba, or vice versa. And there no first name should be used at all. It's inappropriate for a little kid to be using a first name to call a step-parent. This, I believe, is an important point that sometimes is overlooked in our troubled world. Question number two. A majority of the community wants an area built according to the highest standards of halacha. However, a sizable vocal minority feels that an eruv should not be built. If building an eruv would cause such machlokas, should the majority refrain because of the minority? Now, let's take a step backwards. There's a mitzvah to make an eruv for two reasons. One, in the absence of the eruv, there's chilul Shabbos, people carrying anyway. And two, it's a major inconvenience. If you look in Shulchan Aruch and Shin Samach Vav, Sif Yud Gimel, and Shin Samach Hei, Shin Tzadi Hei Sif Aleph. So much so that in Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat it says, Simen Kuf Samach Bei Sif Aleph, Kofin Zeh Zeh. They can force one another to raise the funds necessary to build the Eruv. It's an interesting question the Achronim have. What about someone who doesn't want to use the Eruv? Can he be compelled to donate to the construction and upkeep of the Eruv? That's an unanswered question. But to protest against the construction of an Eruv, one would have to have an extremely cogent reason to do so. No reason is given by the questioner. Maybe it's a theoretical question, and therefore one cannot answer a theoretical question with a practical answer. Seems to me that without a very good reason why one would feel that an Eruv should not be built, that the minority is only a minority, and we follow the majority as a general rule, and it's prohibited for the minority to involve itself in any machlokas. It's simply prohibited. It's impossible to have the tyranny of the minority to prevent forward progress, unless it's a very significant reason why the Eruv shouldn't be built. Now, of course, one reason may be they don't want to rely on these highest standards of halacha. You can always find something wrong with an Eruv. The proper response to that is, okay, you don't want to use the Eruv, it's fine. But don't prevent others from using the Eruv. Don't prevent an Eruv from being constructed. That's my take on the matter. And again, I can't give a specific answer because the question is not specific. Question three. This coming Shabbat Rosh Chodesh, if you are in a camp hotel, to what level does the camp hotel need to go to attain a second Sefer Torah? Could they just roll from Chukas to Pinchas while making a Mishaberech for Cholim? If there's only one Torah, do you do Hagbah on that Torah and then only then start the Mafter, or do you just roll the Torah and continue? Of course, ideally you should have two Sefer Torahs, we well know. If you're in a pinch, you only need two. One is enough. Specifically, this particular month, where from Chukas to Pinchas is so short, there's not even a second of Tircha de Tzibura, and you do not require a Hagbah in between. So again, if you can find a second Sefer, it's great. If you can't, you can certainly do without in the month of Tammuz, when there's almost a zero roll. And other months, perhaps you should try a little bit harder. Again, except for Rosh Chodesh Av, it's also almost a no roll if that happens. Okay, question number four. What are the parameters to allow a Levaya for a shul member in the shul sanctuary? Last session we discussed about a shul that made a tanai to allow kiddush in the shul. Must the tanai be made to allow for levayas? The Gemara is a case where a levaya was allowed because there was no other adequate place to have the levaya. And I believe that it should be mutter in such a circumstance. There's no other place in town where they can accommodate such a crowd, for example. I think it's okay. However, it should be emphasized that one may not allow the coffin, the Aron, to come into the shul at all. That's absolutely a no-no. But if the coffin stays outside in the hearse, then I believe it's permissible to permit a levaya in a shul. I don't even think you need it tonight. A levaya, which is generally a very somber event, it should lead to tshuva. So the shul is an appropriate place for it to happen. Again, I'm assuming that it's a proper levaya. Question number five. My shul recently purchased karka. My two kohanim are asking about a location that will let their kohen sons could go visit them. Are there halachically acceptable ways to allow kohanim to visit their parents? If a kohen can approach the kever of a parent without being at any time within 4 amos, about 7 feet, of any of the kvarim, it's permissible. This is often the case in Eretz Yisrael. There are wider pathways to go on by foot or by car. We are never closer than 7 feet to any of the kvarim. In America, there's a greater problem because of the overhanging trees. If they overhang the kever and the car or the kohen at the same time, it's a potential problem. And that's why kohanim in America don't go to cemeteries. Is it really a halachic problem? Strictly speaking, it's not completely clear. Could be that tumas mace does not go by ohel, since each and every leaf is not a tefach by tefach, and you don't really combine them. That's a complex question in Hilchos Tumas Kohanim. But nonetheless, the general practice is not to approach the kever if you're a kohen. Okay. 6. Parameters for tevila bayom. What constitutes adequate extenuating circumstances to allow tevila bayom shvi or yom shmini? And if it is permitted, what other conditions are required, such as the couple will be separated until dark? What happens if the couple will be eating with others, e.g. Friday night Suda, before it gets dark? This is a very good question. Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Tzadi Zayin Sif Gimel in Yerodea, it says on the 8th day, a woman may not go to the mikveh by day. She could have gone last night. She may not go the following day because of what's called Sirach Bita. The daughter who will sense that the mother's going to the mikveh will not have no way of knowing whether it's day 7 or day 8. She'll think it's day 7. When she gets married, she'll go to the mikveh day 7. And then she'll be with her husband, and then she'll see blood. Shematira v'tistar. So it's a disaster. So to prevent that from happening, Chazal said you may not go to the mikveh by day, even day number 8. However, since it's only a chashash, only a possibility of the daughter making a mistake, what's known as Srach Pita, Shulchan Aruch and Siv Dalet, based on the Gemaras, give certain extenuating circumstances when the 8th day you may go to the mikveh, since you cannot go to the mikveh the night before or the night after. For example, it's dangerous. You can't leave go to the mikveh at night. Or there's a lack of tznius. When you go at night, the world's going to find out that you're going to the mikveh. There are other cases. Let's say a woman is working every night. She's a nurse. And she's on in the summertime. She's on from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., 12-hour shifts the whole week. She just can't go to the mikveh at night, and she's unable to come. Whatever, there's some kind of an onus, whether it's a general onus to the town or a personal onus to the individual, according to almost all poskim, that's sufficient reason to allow her to go to the mikveh on day 8. Ideally, she should hide this from her husband. Certainly, she may not have relations by day, and anyway, by day, there's an issue of tznius. And yes, some say, ideally, she should not come back home, if possible, until after it gets dark. This is on day number 8. Day number 7 is much more serious. Day number 7, according to most authorities, one may not go to the mikveh, even if one cannot go to the mikveh that subsequent night. Wait till the next day. Wait till day 8. That's a psak. Now, it's clear day 8 is permissible only if she is unable to go to the mikveh on the two nights surrounding it, the night after the 7th and the night after the 8th. She can't go on those two nights. She can go on the intervening day. So it's clear that the 7th, you may not go to the mikveh, even though you're unable to go the next two nights. Only the 8th is permissible between the night after 7 and 8, not the 7th. But one could suggest that if the woman is unable to go to the mikveh 3 nights in a row, after 7, 8, and 9, then the Chochmas Adam seems to say that it's okay. And I believe we can rely upon it, even though there are those who disagree. And in fact, in our mikveh in Riverdale, we do rely upon the Chochmas Adam in special cases. When the woman is unable to go to the mikveh 3 days in a row subsequently, either because she's flying off to a place where there is no mikveh, that can happen, or it's a three-day antif. She lives too far away. I had a very interesting case 30 years ago, perhaps even more. A woman called and said that she lives in over a mile north of where the mikveh is, and she hurt her ankle. And if I say that she has to go at night, she'll go at night. But it's Hoshana Rabbah on a Wednesday. So if she's not unable to walk, she cannot go Wednesday night or Thursday night or Friday night. And the psak was given that she may go on Wednesday in the very late afternoon, drive home in time for lich benchen, gives her an 18-minute margin, make sure that her husband goes to shul before she returns. And in this way, in a very difficult situation such as this, we ruled leniently on this matter. Remarkably, a number of months later, this lady meets me and tells me, "Rabbi, you saved my life." I said, "What happened?" She said, "Remember the psak?" I said, "Yes." Well, she went to the emergency room on Motsoi Shabbos 3.5 days later because her ankle still bothered her. They took an x-ray and they found that the ankle was fractured. So she asked the doctor, "What would have happened if I had walked a mile and a half on this ankle?" He said, "Oh, it would have been a complete and absolute disaster. You probably would have had to have surgeries and pins and the works." So, Baruch Hashem, we paskened correctly in that particular situation. I have to tell you that there are those
stay on the line. And you.
Hello, Rabbi, are you there? Hello? Hello? Hello.
All of our representatives.
Hello?
Hello?
Rabbi Hammer. Hello, Rabbi Hammer.
Hello?
Hello, Rabbi Hammer.
This is not him. There's only two of us here.
What?
There's only two of us here.
I don't know. I heard Rabbi Hammer only on the line.
Yeah, he just jumped on for a second. I don't know what happened. I think everybody has to call back.
Did something happen with the... I'm calling in late and
yeah.
I don't hear anything happening.
Oh, all right. Yeah. the shear was going beautifully and then all of a sudden it all went silent. And
I hope that didn't happen because I called in.
No, I don't imagine you're that powerful.
No, I wouldn't think so either. I didn't know that it was possible. Usually when I call in, it's muted automatically, and it's not able... I didn't know I was able to unmute myself. But
yeah.
I have... Are they going to restart the share, or do we know what...
I emailed from Hammer, and he said that he's trying to get it back.
I hear. Okay. I'm
calling back on mute. I'm hanging out. You can hang out with me, but I'm calling back on mute.
Okay.
I noticed that the connection to the conference call went off at some time. I'm not exactly sure when. So I'm going to go quickly to the beginning of question 8, just to may have to review something. We said briefly that there's only one shul in town, and most of the community are in that shul. The minority that has to keep accept Shabbos early. However, if the majority is not in shul, even if they're accepting Shabbos at home, then the minority is not required to follow the majority. In this case, the majority is at home, not in shul. No need to accept early Shabbos. There's a second shul where they daven bizman. Then that shul is not required to follow the first shul, the majority shul. Someone who's at home, according to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, in Reish Samach Gimel, if you test, is required to follow the majority. Here it doesn't say in the question where the person is. If he's at home, he should follow the majority. If he's in the shul, which daven's late, he's not required to do so. Yes, Rav Moshe says if you're doing it for your own convenience, the idea of the minority having to follow the majority does not apply, but Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Vozna disagree, and therefore we cannot rely on Rav Moshe except for a tzir with other considerations. And finally, D, what happens if someone is in a vacation spot as a caterer and he wants to drive back home? In my opinion, he's not need not follow the majority. He's not a Ben Ear. He lives somewhere else. Just happens to be there to be able to do the catering. I don't think he's bound by the majority of that particular place. Question 9. My shul has been known for many, many years to only allow people who are Shomer Shabbos to daven for the Yomit on Shabbos and Yom Tov. While this practice served the shul well for quite some time over the past 20 years, the number of Shomer Shabbos members has decreased so much that each Shabbos we now have at most 2 to 3 people who are both Shomer Shabbos and able to lead the daven, myself included in that number. This not only puts a major burden on the very few people who can daven, but it also creates a somewhat stale environment where no one else is being encouraged to be active in the minyan. Proof of which, perhaps, is that Shabbos attendance has been steadily declining for years. Would it be permissible to start allowing people who are not Shomer Shabbos to daven? The answer is, the first and most important criterion for Shliach Tiber, the merutz of the call. I think that the main call is those who are Shomer Shabbos. If the people who are part of the Shomer Shabbos call are okay with the fact that someone who is not Shomer Shabbos should be the Shliach Tiber, so in a Shas Atchah Godol such as this, one could be lenient. But otherwise, not. Question 10. During Q&A sessions a few weeks ago, in discussing a question about Kohanim, a woman in the audience said nonchalantly that her husband only found out 10 years ago he's a Kohen. 10 years ago, the Kohen's aunt said to him, "Of course your father's a Kohen." That was the only information he had. No other proof existed he's a Kohen. The father was not from this particular Kohen, isn't afraid from himself. How should one proceed with this Kohen status? Asking directly may cause him to be offended. The truth is, according to the strict halacha, he's not a Kohen at all. There's no basis for it, no tradition, no fact. Just the one aunt said it. It doesn't really count. You tell him that it's not so good to be a Kohen. What if he or someone else wants to marry a woman that is unsuitable for a Kohen? It's preferred that he stop conducting himself as a Kohen because halakhically he's not considered to be a Kohen based on the fact that one aunt and says it and no one is from in the family going up 2 generations. That's the best thing to do. If it cannot be done, so you'll have to just make a note that you don't really have proof that he's a Kohen, in case it's necessary down the road. Final question. What is the halakha regarding transporting Sefer Torah? Many travel camps are transporting Torahs by plane, train, bus, and automobile. Our camp wraps the Torah in a talus and then a duffel bag and carries the Torah onto the plane. Can the Torah be put in the overhead bin? I assume it means the overhead bin of the plane. The answer is yes. Can be placed under the plane or bus as luggage? A plane, absolutely not. Things get thrown around. In a bus, only if it's impossible to put it in some overhead bin on top or to hold it. And finally, the trunk of a car is permissible because it's a very, it's a safe place and it's not thrown around. Should a seat be purchased for the Torah and strapped into a seat on the plane? No. That's not a proper use of the money. And finally, at the hotel motel campsite, where should the Torah be stored? May it lie flat or only standing up? The answer is you should put it into an Aron, ideally an Aron Kodesh made for that purpose. Standing up, obviously, like in shul. If there's no official Aron Kodesh, they should put it into a plain closet. Ideally, should be standing up. And if it's impossible, it's even permissible if it's lying down. We're cutting this conference call short because of the technical difficulties. Thank you very much.